Hi, everybody. I'm really happy to be here. My name is Shore. My preferred gender pronouns are they and them. And I'm totally going to go off book. Like, I clearly had this whole thing prepared. But there's just a couple things that I want to acknowledge that have happened in the world and some of our communities. Leslie Feinberg, an activist in a lot of our communities, has passed away a couple days ago. And so I wanted to just take a moment of silence and, you know, give some thought and, what's the word I'm looking for? Intentionality and acknowledgement to Leslie in this moment. So if we could all just take a moment. So as I was thinking about Leslie and the work that Leslie has done in so many different issues and in LGBT communities and trans communities and for workers' rights, for racial justice, Leslie's done a lot of work. I really started thinking about the work that I do and how this relates to my presentation today. And this is where I'm going off book, right? And why I think it's so important to do community-based research. And that's kind of been my thing. It's what I've been doing for the last few years. And for me, that's really about finding ways of translating this work in communities, finding power in community so that communities can grow around understanding what research means, how to do it, and how to talk about it. So that's kind of a really brief synopsis of why I do this work. And for some reason, that felt really important to talk about more than methodology today when I was reflecting about Leslie. So that's just a little bit about me. Now I'll talk about some methods and some other stuff. So I'm going to be talking to you about a community-based needs assessment that I worked on out of Minnesota. I worked with a local organization called the Minnesota Transgender Health Coalition, and together we put together the first needs assessment that we've done in Minnesota in trans and gender nonconforming communities. It was very exciting. And I'll talk a little bit more about the process as I continue. Oh, and this is my disclosure that I don't have any things. That I don't have any financial relationships with commercial interests. I was told I had to do that. So just to expand a little bit on community-based research, again, this is the first community-based research project out of Minnesota in trans communities, the first research needs assessment out of the Minnesota Trans Health Coalition, and all of the pieces of this project were developed in collaboration with community members, with the board of the organization, and with folks that are working on these issues in Minnesota, so that's pretty awesome. So the research questions that the folks that I was working with really wanted to focus on were: what barriers exist in receiving healthcare for transgender and gender nonconforming people in Minnesota, and are there any differences via gender identity group? Talk about a little bit of the method. So within our research design, we did a cross-sectional study and a convenience sample. We did a survey. So what that means is, you know, it was a snapshot in time where we had individuals, you know, participate in our survey, and it was anonymous and voluntary. We modeled the survey design off of previous needs assessments that were done in trans communities. The one that we modeled it off both most was the survey done by Sanchez in 2009 in New York City. And they had a pretty decent, the reason we did that was because they had an awesome barriers matrix that we modeled it after. And so that was a wonderful resource to be able to use. All of our survey instruments were pre-tested by community members that were on the board, in the community, and by the executive director of the organization. Just to talk a little bit more about some of the measures that we used, I mentioned a barriers matrix. We asked participants to rate on a Likert scale about a number of different barriers that we pulled from surveys similar to this. And then we asked a number of demographic questions and healthcare utilization questions as well. For our analysis, we used data 2.0, and we had a pretty decent sample size. I'll talk a little bit more about our sample in a minute. But so we ended up having 183 total folks. We were able to use 100, our final N was 144. So for a small community-based survey, that was like, oh my gosh, 144, that's amazing. But for statistical analysis, that proved to be quite a struggle at some points in terms of breaking down categories, and I'm sure we all struggle with these things, especially when it comes to self-identification categories. So we were able to do some bivariate analyses to assess the association between certain gender groups. We ended up having to create two main gender groups that we ended up using in the analysis, and that was a trans masculine group and a trans feminine group. I'll talk about how we created those groups in a moment. And not everybody fit in those groups, clearly. So these are just a few of the sample questions that I wanted to talk about in terms of how we identified people's gender identity. This was a really big part of a lot of the discussions in community. Like, how do we, and remember, this was before the Genius Group released the two-step method of how to collect data, okay? So just to give you that, it was right actually just before that in 2011. And so we had a lot of conversations about how do we make people feel safe taking a survey, and how do we also get really good data? And so we ended up asking four different questions, and they were, do you identify with the sex assigned to you at birth? And that was dichotomous. How do you self-identify your current gender identity? And there were a lot of responses there, probably too many in retrospect, but that's also really debatable, right? We know this. There's no good necessarily answer. And what sex were, and then what sex, which sex were you assigned at birth? And what gender do you currently live as? And in retrospect, clearly, I think we could have done this a little bit better, but that's what we did at the time. And so once we went through all of these criteria and looked at kind of how these four questions parsed out for folks, our final sample size of folks that had some sort of trans-lived experience, that's how we talked about it, was 144, as I mentioned. So this is a breakdown of how people self-identified their gender identity. 30% of our respondents identified as trans-masculine, 19% as trans-feminine, 8% identified as transgender, 15% identified as genderqueer, 2% as two-spirit, 11% as male, and 13% as female, and 2% as other. And so when we were creating groups for analysis, what we did is we took the folks who identified as female and trans-feminine and made a trans-feminine group. And we took the folks who identified as male and trans-masculine and made a trans-masculine group for analysis, because we were looking at, and then those are the two main groups that we compared. Unfortunately, the cell sizes and the numbers for the other groups were too small to use in a comparative analysis, so we were not able to do them. But we have a lot of frequencies about it, so that's really good information too, right? Sorry, that's too high. So these are just a few sample characteristics. I have a number of slides like this. I'm going to kind of move kind of quickly through them, so please, if you have questions, we can do that at the end. But just to kind of give you a little example of our community, one-fifth of the respondents identified as heterosexual, 82% identified as white, about two-thirds had some sort of college or graduate degree, but two-thirds also earned less than $30,000 a year. And about three-quarters of our respondents were using hormones for transition, and 40% had surgery for transition. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the results in terms of the barriers. So we asked quite a few barrier questions. The first one was, do you have access to a trans-friendly provider? About two-thirds of the people said no. No is blue. Yes is red. Again, about two-thirds said that they did not have access to a provider that was knowledgeable about trans health. When folks were asked, are they confident that their provider would use the correct pronouns when addressing them, the correct name and pronouns, about 57% said yes. And then when asked about paperwork and whether they were given the option of self-identifying or having a preferred name, about 63% said no. So this is just a continuation. Sorry if the numbers are a little small. But so to just go through a few more of these barriers, when folks were asked if there were gender-accessible restrooms at their facility, about 60% said yes. When people were asked if that was an issue for them when seeking a provider, About 55% of them said yes, so it was pretty split. When folks were asked if they were able to find affordable and adequate transportation, about 80% of them said yes. And when they were asked if they were able when they were asked if there were places where they can get medical care located in safe spaces for them, safe locations, about 80% of them again said yes. And when they were asked if medical care was too expensive for them, that was about 60% who said yes. So costs seemed to be an issue. And then language barriers were not an issue for this sample. So some of the key points that we took away from this particular needs assessment were, in our community in particular, there were high levels of education and insurance and high levels of interaction with the healthcare system. However, many participants were still experiencing barriers to that healthcare system, particularly having access to trans-friendly and trans-competent providers. In terms of our bivariate analysis, we didn't have any statistically significant results, and many of them were actually very similar by the trans-feminine and trans-masculine group in comparison in terms of frequencies as well, so the rates were about the same. And this did not speak to all trans communities, clearly. This is just this sample. So some other things to think about clearly around this is, for me, around the education and access and high levels of interaction with the system, but still low levels of pay. So we had a lot of folks who were low income in our sample, but were having high levels of interaction with the health insurance system and the educational system. So that was a really interesting part of this sample. So some of the limitations of this study were that clearly it was a convenience sample. It is not generalizable to the general trans population. It was a pretty small sample size. It was really hard to do comparisons with the numbers that we have. And it didn't include all barriers that people face, so that is something to take into consideration as well. And it didn't measure the magnitude of the barriers. So what that means is we asked, is this a barrier for you, yes or no, but not how much. And so that's something that there could be further research about. And it didn't compare the barriers that this population had to other populations in Minnesota. So yeah, that's what I have for you all today. Thanks for having me, and if you all have any questions.
We'll take a few questions.
Thank you. Are you aware of any data, not necessarily your own, that tracks these kinds of outcomes over time? Any data at all, because it seems to me there's such rapid change going on that there might be some trends over time.
That's a really good question. So I know that I currently live in Wisconsin and do similar work there, and I know that there are nonprofit agencies in the communities that I came from and the communities that I currently live in that do sort of track these types of data over time, but again, it's all in needs assessment form. So I don't know if there are any longitudinal studies that are going on, and I don't know if any other panelists know that question in terms of barriers to care. Or other folks in the room. Yeah.
Yes, I have a question, which is, I've seen, you know, this replicated in other studies, maybe more trans-masculine population, maybe more the Midwest, where you have highly educated,
So we did not measure any mental health outcomes, depression, anxiety, anything like that. So I can't speak to it to this population or to this sample, really. And I think that there is some literature out there that does speak to that in terms of mental health outcomes and both access to stable to jobs and to, you know, the job market and to employment security. I don't know how much of that is out there, though, unfortunately, in terms of data and research. So I don't know if anybody else does. Yes. So that's a really good question. Again, so because we weren't able to measure the magnitude or really dive into like some of the reasons that some barriers exist. So I'm not really sure based on this particular sample why people weren't happy or like what the barrier was with their providers. Like, and again, like that this is a limitation of the study is that what does knowledgeable about trans healthcare really mean to any one given person? Like, it could be really different. And unfortunately, that's a pretty big limitation about this information in particular. So I don't know about this study, what that means for these folks. Yes. That's a really good question, and I think really complex, and, you know, there need to be some movement around longitudinal research and LGBT communities overall for something like that to happen. And I think that it is, like, I think that a lot of folks are starting to do these types of needs assessments in their communities, and part of it is how to move them forward and continue doing action-based community research, right? And so, like, we do this needs assessment, and then what happens? And then how do we continue doing it in a sustainable way to see what is changing? Because this is a couple of years old now, and the landscape might very well be very different after there's been some activism around this, which has happened in Minnesota. So so I didn't really answer your question, did I?
So just one more, and then...
I was just going to talk about that. I found in my own research doing the snowball effect. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there needs to be community buy-in, which is pretty important. So, awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.